You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
There was a time when our homes had locks and our safety depended on solid doors and strong bolts. Today, our doors are digital, invisible, but infinitely more vulnerable. In an age where our lives live online, our money, our memories, our movements, cybersecurity has quickly become one of the greatest civil rights issues of our time. And yet for many of us, it remains a fog of half-truths and myths. We think Apple devices can't be hacked. We think complex passwords are our shields. We think I'm too small to be a target. But here's the unsettling truth. Cyber criminals aren't chasing status. All they're chasing is opportunity. And so tonight we enter the digital battlefield armed not with fear, but with knowledge. To guide us through this world of firewalls, phishing, and false security is a man who has spent his career defining the vulnerable corners of our connected world. Muyoa Mutemoa is a cybersecurity expert and thought leader, helping individuals and organizations alike to not just survive the digital age, but to secure it. Muyoa, welcome back to the show. We are so ready to be enlightened by you as always.
Hi, evening to your listeners, evening to you as well. I hope everyone is doing well.
No, we're doing all right. Thank you. Let's start here. In your experience, what is the single most dangerous cybersecurity myth that the average person still believes today?
So I would say it's overconfidence. Overconfidence where someone says, no, you know what, I've when it comes to cybersecurity, I've got it. I've got it. And I think that tends to be the biggest myth. Because usually the ones that say I've got it, they're the ones that are in trouble and they don't actually realize it because of the overconfidence.
So I'd say that get got.
The ones that get got. Yeah, I'd say that's probably the biggest one.
Interesting. We've mentioned a few myths. Well, and I think over the time that we've spoken, there are some things we have gone over, you know, and one that surprises me is people believing that Apple devices can't be hacked or that a strong password is enough. Which of these half-truths do you find most frustrating as a professional and why is that the case?
Well, let's start first with the Apple one, because I think the Apple one would probably be one of the biggest if overconfidence wasn't there. So this comes back from the days when, you know, viruses used to be known on Windows devices. You know, you knew as soon as someone inserted a USB or a memory stick or whatever you call it, there would be a virus transmission from one computer to the next. And it was quite big. So when Apple devices, both the iPhone, the tablets, the MacBooks, the Mac Pros, the Air, whatever you call them, when they came on the scene, a lot of people felt, I am now moving to a device that doesn't have all of these viruses. And that became, I would say, the second most biggest myth, because a lot of people then, you know, they're not just buying status with Apple devices. They're sort of buying security in quotation marks, which doesn't exist. So that tends to be a big myth. And the reason why that's the case is threat actors have sort of realized these are the people who actually have the money. So, you know, if someone says, I want to go buy a computer, and they have a choice between a normal Windows machine or a MacBook, you can already see there's status and there's money there. And people actually target those ones. And so there's quite a lot of viruses written for Mac because of the market. You've got a different market you're serving there. Whereas on Windows, you've got a bigger pool, but on Mac, you've got, you know, the cream de la creme of society.
Yeah, and the one about strong passwords being enough, because what I've tended to do now, and I don't know how safe this is, Google just says, here's a strong password for you. Do you want to use your face to secure it? And I'm like, save and fail. Is that the way to go?
Well, that's a good point, because, you know, we've spoken so long about why people need to have strong passwords. It's very important. But at the same time, you need to then realize, okay, which website am I using the strong password on? Because a lot of the time when we arrive on site, I'm talking about myself and my team, sometimes we find that, you know, here's a big organization, perhaps even a bank. They've storing everyone's strong password in clear text. So what that means is the place where the passwords are stored to verify when you type in your password, that place for them where it's stored, they don't ensure that it's stored in a way that anyone cannot read it.
Yeah.
You find that as soon as you get access, you can read everything. And sometimes what you find is people dump that information on dark webs, and now you can find username and passwords, very strong usernames and passwords.
Yeah. And while we're on passwords, I think I've heard that one should change their password every 3 months. Does that actually make us safer, or is that a myth that belongs in the past?
Well, this is one of those that can be a myth, and it can also be something that makes people safe.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example. If my password is Muyowa001, and then next month I'm changing my password to Muyowa002. Trust me, all the corporate people just look, stop what they're doing, because they do this a lot. when it's the new month and they need to change their password, they just iterate and add a one at the end. The challenge with that is when the password is discovered, I can then immediately guess the next password. And someone actually says this. He says, if you take that number and you divide it by 12, you can see how long the person has been in the organization. So
it's just they have their password on retainer, and so do the scammers as well, have them on retainer.
You know. So in as much as we need to change passwords, we also need to change password to completely different to what they were. When I mean completely different, my password for next month can't be Muyowa003. It has to be maybe Itumeleng 2018. You know, I'm not saying Itumeleng has got anything to do with anything, but the point is your passwords need to be strong. They need to be as much as possible randomized.
Yeah.
And I think in the past we talked about password managers, tools that can help us generate random passwords and store them securely for us.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let's get into an exercise of busting at least 10 myths, right? I've got a list here with me that I'm going to go randomly through based on things we perhaps haven't discussed. And then all of them are myths. You can just help bust them.
Let's call them quick hits.
Sorry?
Quick hits.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Number one, incognito mode keeps me anonymous.
That's a myth.
Muyowa, tread softly now. What do you mean?
It's a myth, because what tends to happen on the internet is your internet service provider can see you and can see what you're doing.
Yeah.
Irrespective of what you are doing, they can see what websites you go to. They can see how long you've been on the website. They can see how much information has been exchanged between your computer and the website. Mm. And the website service provider can actually see what device you're using. So they can go back down. Is this a MacBook? Was it the MacBook from this year? Was the MacBook from last year?
Yeah.
They can see quite a lot of information. And there's even some cases where websites have got cookies meant to even scan the applications installed on your device, so like your phone or your laptop. So incognito mode, it's just meant to prevent you from using cookies with a saved account. So let's say, for example, you're logged into your iCloud account. When you use incognito mode, when you try to log on to iCloud, it's now considered as a new session. But But a fun fact is, when you use incognito mode, Google still knows who you are. So they
Crazy
will never
business.
ask you to say, please confirm whether you're human. That's when they're not sure who you are. Not they don't know who you are.
Yeah.
They're not sure of who you are.
Well, there you have it, folks. There you have it, folks. You and your bad tendencies. You are not as anonymous as you think. Here's another one that I saw, especially a lot during COVID, because people were home and they had a lot of time on their hands. Social media quizzes are harmless fun. I think for me, the one that caught my attention is when people were like, or when this particular quiz was like, share your maiden name. And I'm just like, do people not realize that data is being collected about them? So let's talk about that one.
Well, that's a myth. So sometimes what marketers will try and do, let's say, for example, I've got a product. I'm selling a product called Confidential. And I want to see the people who are going to use this Confidential. What sort of people are they? So what I'll do is I'll engage an online service to do a quiz and collect information about my customers and then collect information about people who are not my customers. So send it specifically to these two groups. And what I get from that is information that these two groups have given this intermediary without even realizing it. And then all of a sudden, as a product manufacturer of something called Confidential, I now know my customers and I now know my potential customers in terms of information that they would generally not be giving it to anyone.
This one I need us to talk about. The biggest lie people tell. I'm pretty sure you know what it is as somebody who works in tech. I have read the terms and conditions and I agree. Let's talk about app permissions and our idea that they don't really matter.
All right. So let's start with the terms and conditions. I think Google and Facebook have faced GDPR laws in Europe where their terms and conditions were so long and complicated that users weren't even reading them. They were just accepting them. And in those terms and conditions, what Google and Facebook were doing was violating user permissions. So, for example, users were giving up too much information than they should have. So you were giving permission to Google to for example, collect information and store information about you for as long as you. Now, terms and conditions are very important because when you use a service, you must agree to the terms and conditions. If you don't agree, you are allowed to not use the service. Now, when we don't read terms and conditions, at least now, I think in light of those cases where Google and Facebook lost, they've tried to then try to minimize the terms and conditions. So we need to at least have an idea of what the terms and conditions say, right? If we don't, we must also check what the app permissions are. So let's say, for example, you're downloading a new game. It's a game. Or you're downloading your banking app. Let's talk about your banking app. Your banking app wants access to your microphone. It wants access to your location. It wants access to your contacts. It wants access to seeing what applications you've downloaded. It wants access to your health. And sometimes we see applications that have got nothing to do with the microphone, asking for the microphone permissions. You grant that app permissions to the microphone. All of a sudden now, it can turn on the microphone at will, right? It can turn on the camera at will. So that's the danger with app permissions. And one of the things that we need to do is, in as much as we are getting an app, let's say from someone who's popular or a big organization, let's say like a bank or maybe a government entity, we can't just trust that the developers of that app have your best interest at heart. As a user, you must review those permissions and then you must come to say, okay, you know what? I'm happy to give these permissions. Let's say, for example, which one can I pick on? Let's say WhatsApp. you can actually deny WhatsApp permission to access your microphone. Mm. It just means that you will not be able to make and receive calls. Mm. Yeah.
And what are the implications of what are the bad ways? I don't even know how to ask this question. What are the bad ways of granting these apps permissions that they don't need?
Well, the permissions can be misused,
yeah.
For lack of a better word. They can be misused
even
to
by
a way that
reputable sites.
Yeah, to a way that you didn't intend on it being used. So let me give you an example.
Mm.
Reputable sites have been known. When I mean reputable sites, I'm going to pick on the two that I mentioned, Google and Facebook.
Mm.
They have been known for collecting information on their users and for actually influencing the popular opinion or the trending stories.
Mm.
So this is in the case of Facebook with Cambridge Analytica in the US, where it was known during Trump's first term that they did interfere in the US elections.
Mm.
This is known. So unfortunately, in such cases, the users of that application gave permission to the application.
Mm.
And that ended up being something completely different, being an impact to what they would have seen. Who would know that technology could have played a big impact in the political discussions in the country? No one knows that.
Yeah. Hectic. Deleted files are gone forever.
This is a fun one. what I'm saying, this is a very interesting myth, is so in my line of work, we deal with what we call digital forensic investigations.
Mm.
In simple terms, when someone is broken into your house physically, you call a specialist to come and see how the person got in the house, what they stole, what they touched, and so on.
Mm.
So in the world of computers, we also have forensic specialists.
Mm.
So let's say, for example, someone is allegedly accused of committing a crime.
Mm.
We need to come in and look at their phone and retrieve information, messages, and things that has been deleted.
Mm.
And most of the time, it becomes very interesting. With let's say, for example, the one that makes me laugh all the time is WhatsApp.
Yeah.
So WhatsApp people have these 24-hour disappearing messages.
Yes.
So, you would find someone is standing there and they're saying, "I did not send that message," and this is now a criminal investigation. Maybe it involves murder or something. "I did not send that message." And what the police can now do is they can now get a Section 205 and subpoena WhatsApp or Facebook, depending on who owns the servers for WhatsApp. And that company can then retrieve all of those messages and hand them over and say, "Yeah, here you go. Here's confirmed information that you indeed sent these messages that meant harm to this person." So a lot of the time, pictures that are deleted, conversations that are deleted, phone calls that are deleted can be retrieved, especially when it comes to computers, phones. Computers, it has to do with a lot of fraud. So within organizations, sometimes we are called because, you know, here's an interesting story, actually.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, we're working on a case. These two people in two different departments,
yeah,
who we did our investigation, didn't see any link between them.
Mm.
So what happened was these two individuals were given a job offer. You know, everyone gets, "We are pleased to inform you," they send you a PDF document, you sign it, and then you send it back.
Yeah.
So one individual converted that PDF document to a Word document and then changed the figures. After changing the figures, increase them, sign that document, and no one actually checks that.
Mm.
And then once he saw he got paid, he told his friend, "Hey, listen, I changed this thing and it happened." So the friend also converted to Word, changed the figures, saved it back, signed it, sent it back in. It was only when the budget for that department came around and they realized, no, the numbers don't add. Makes sense here. Did we hire someone beyond what they were supposed to get? And they did the investigation. eventually they got down to two people that were hired, and the amounts that they were supposed to be getting, let's say it was 100 rand, these guys were getting 105, and they realized, no, something doesn't make sense here. So they looked at the contracts that they sent them, and then they looked at the ones that they received, and they saw there was a discrepancy in the numbers. So they called us, we picked up those laptops for these two guys, and then once we picked up the laptops, man, these guys were like, nope, we didn't have anything. These documents are not on their computers. By the time we were done with the forensic investigations, we were able to retrieve the Word documents, we were able to retrieve the PDF documents, the original and the edited one, and we were able to say, here are the documents. Here's proof of the documents. So deleted messages and deleted information. What tends to happen, actually, to explain it in simple terms, think about a book. A book has got a table of contents. When you delete the information, you're just tearing the table of contents page. That actual page is still there. Page 620 is still there.
Yeah.
Same info. Yeah.
Oh, but also, the things people do. Why don't I have the mind of a criminal? I'd be so rich. I'd be so rich. Let's talk about the rise of remote work. Because I think it's blurred the lines between personal and professional spaces. So how vulnerable does that make the average person then? And what are the biggest mistakes that remote workers still make to this day?
So one of the biggest myths that remote workers have is the same protection they had on their network, they still have it all. What they're forgetting is at home, you know, your corporate laptop, it's managed by the organization, the updates, the patching, you know.
Yeah.
Basically, what I'm saying is they update the operating system and your application, make sure that they're up to date. And they ensure that there's security. But what remote workers don't realize is their laptop can be safe, but the devices around them, the TV hasn't been updated in a long time, but it's connected to the internet. The phone is so old, but it hasn't been updated in a long time. The spare laptop that's used at home is so old, and they're surrounded by a lot of unsecure devices with outdated operating system and apps, and those can be compromised to attack a corporate device or to listen in on the conversation on a corporate device. So these are some things that remote workers sort of miss when they're home, and they take it for granted. I think that's one of the biggest myths that they're faced with. Yeah.
Sure. Public Wi-Fi. We love it. We use it, and some of us even trust it. Sometimes too much. How dangerous is it really? And are there any safe ways to use it without exposing ourselves?
Good question. So public Wi-Fi is common in the sense that we use it for quite a number of things. It's easy internet. And one of the things we believe when we're on there, no, as long as I see the padlock on this website, I'm okay. But public Wi-Fi, there tends to be a lot of people on there just trying to listen into conversation. So it's almost as good as saying, you're in the middle of New York, right? And I always make this example. You're in the middle of New York and you're going to speak in your mother tongue, a South African language. You're going to speak isiZulu. And you're hoping that there is no one there who is going to hear you. And you're going to tell your friend, you're going to shout across the street. You're going to tell your friend where you're keeping the money. Right? With the hope that everyone around you is not going to hear. That's pretty much public Wi-Fi. That even in places where we use public Wi-Fi, we must see what applications are we using. Maybe limit the use of applications such as banking apps, some social media accounts that we don't want someone to have access to. Let's say, for example, Instagram or Facebook. If it's not important for you, if it's lost, then you probably don't want to use it on there.
Then what are we going to use the public Wi-Fi for? YouTube?
Well, YouTube is one of them,
Okay.
but what tends to happen with authentication, how you verify that you are who you are on a service. So a service would be like Instagram. You need to verify who you are before you're given access to your account.
Yeah.
Is app will probably request some sort of authentication token, and when that token is captured, someone can replay that token and also get authentication as well. So these are things, unfortunately, that tends to happen on a public Wi-Fi. So those who use it a lot, I would say use something that you don't really would care if it got lost.
Okay. Now I'm trying to think through all my apps and like I care about all of it. I care about
Especially
all
the one
of it.
update on a public Wi-Fi. So there's another myth as well where people say, you know what, I'm just gonna update my apps on the public Wi-Fi. I'm gonna go to a McDonald's or and just click update. One of the interesting things that we also deal with is people can actually, what's the word, masquerade the service that's meant to send you the updated application. So they'll give you their version of the application on the public Wi-Fi and you install
Oh,
that.
you know what? I'm already feeling overwhelmed by all the cybersecurity. Just please help me with one small, do you hear me, Muyo? Small, but practical
Yeah.
habit that me and anyone can adopt today that would immediately make us feel safer online. Because it just seems everything we are doing is wrong.
So the beautiful thing about cybersecurity is once you understand the challenges about it, any small thing that you do intentionally plays a big role. And that tends to be very important. I think we tend to want to implement big solutions to cybersecurity in order to mitigate some of these threats. But in reality, it's the small things that we do intentionally, they tend to play a big role. So let's say, for example, if you say to yourself, you know what, when it comes to public Wi-Fi, I'm gonna use the applications that I don't mind if someone steals them or someone hacks into my account, I don't mind. Then that's fine. You're intentionally choosing to minimize what we call the risk. So you are reducing your exposure to the risk, thereby limiting your threat landscape. Okay, let me stop talking in that language. So let's say, for example, you say, okay, you know what, when it comes to banking, I'm going to turn on my data. And in South Africa, we know for some banks and some internet service providers, your Vodacom, Telkom, MTN, Cell C, they do allow you to bank without having active data. So you can say, I'm going to do this on my data connection. You don't lose anything. So those small things, those things that you're intentional about, they tend to play a big role. And I think for anyone who's worried, just pick small things, be intentional about them. It'll make a big difference.
How has the rise of artificial intelligence changed the game? And I mean this both in terms of new threats and the tools that we can use to defend ourselves.
So I think the new threats we've talked about, how it was more difficult for people who created scams to make them look real. Now it's a lot more easier. You can go on ChatGPT and say, ask ChatGPT, please draft an email that I'm going to send to my cousin, and tell him that his uncle passed away. And that you can expect a sum of money. Yeah, ChatGPT will gladly do that.
Oh, shit.
yes. But now, because it's so easy, the important thing that we need to know about is there's also AI that also is implemented to sort of detect the use of AI. So that tends to be simplified this way. AI that can generate new information is called generative AI. And AI can actually detect when generative AI has been used. I hope that's making.
Yeah.
So there is AI that is trained, learning models that are trained to sort of detect when something that has been written or sent to you has been generated using AI itself.
Mm-hmm.
So there we are using AI to sort of defeat AI.
Yeah, we touched on social media earlier, and I know that social media can either be a blessing. Well, not either. It's both a blessing and a battlefield, if we're honest. How much information, Muyoa, are we unwillingly giving away every time we post, every time we click, or every time we share?
Look, so social media tends to be very important. You know, here's a fun fact. On any weekend, if I look at people's social media, I can find out where they are.
Yo.
Down to the very street.
So dangerous.
It's very simple, because then the interesting thing is we love to share as human beings. Yo. We want to tell people that.
Yeah.
We want to tell people we are here.
Yeah.
We are
living. These people.
Living, you know, I have met this person.
Mm.
Funny enough, I actually met two famous people, and I'm yet to post them. So not necessarily that's a good thing, but I'm just saying, with social media, on any given weekend, you can tell where someone is going to be.
Mm.
Now, the interesting thing about that is, with parents, we can tell people who might mean harm to our children the places where our children go to for school.
Mm.
You know how we do that?
Mm-hmm.
We post a picture, first day of school.
Yo, bundle of joy.
Bundle of joy. First day of school, we're posting the school name.
Mm.
And at the time you drop them off. So this person just checks your social media. Oh. So every morning at 8:30 you are posting. Oh, so you drop off your child at 8:30. You're posting pictures of how late you're picking up your child. Oh, okay. So you pick up your child at this time. It then tends to be an area where we are oversharing. Like to all the people who have social workers on their case because of how they are managing their children, because they can just pull that information off social media. So that tends to be quite interesting as well, because we tend to overshare. I remember there was a time where we used to check in.
On Facebook, no? Why.
Yes.
Yeah.
I still don't understand why we're doing that. I'd say part of me as well. I check into places.
I'm seeing now on Instagram you have the option to share your location at every point. And I'm just like, why would we do that?
You see, it goes back to how we are wired as human beings. I think I would like to study the psychology of people and social media. Because what we tend to see on social media is how the person would like to be perceived by others. There's some element of behavior. Our behavior is affected by how we want people to see us. And so when people turn on a service like tracking your social media movement, let's say on Instagram, basically, deep down, that person wants to say, I am now hanging in this area. And if there's someone famous in this area, by association of my location, I may or may not be in the same, crew as this person.
Class. Who's trying to yeah.
Pass, you know? So, there lies the psychology of a human being. Like, why do we do that? Because that tends to put our location, disclosing our location. And sometimes we can say, look, I don't care who sees my location. The whole world can see. I think that's great. But have you thought about the people who are looking to steal from people randomly? Because this happens at malls and things like that. So now when they see, oh, okay, you live this kind of lifestyle and you're going to be in this place or you are in this place, well, let's see if we can find you and maybe collect that iPhone from you. So I think a lot tends to be misunderstood in terms of some of these services. But again, it goes down to who we are as human beings and why we do the that we do.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm not a psychologist, but it's fascinating.
Yes, it's like we're being governed by mass hysteria now. People are barely making sensible choices.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, if we think about cybersecurity not just as tech, but as stewardship, what moral responsibility do we then carry in protecting our data, our families, and even our workplaces?
As stewardship, that's a difficult question. I think it's a multifaceted question, because stewardship has to do with, what's the word for it? I was reading about it the other day. It has to do with managing well the resources that you've been given, right? When you say managing well, it has to go back to God.
Mm.
So when we talk about cybersecurity and stewardship, we need to then try and understand what are the elements within cybersecurity that speak to stewardship.
Mm.
So one of the things that we talked about here is the understanding and the behavior of a person. That's one aspect where you can, you know, without realizing it, put pressure on your neighbor.
Ooh,
you know, you want to be like the Jones next door.
Yeah.
You can put pressure on your neighbor, because the challenge with social media is we never post the bad side.
No.
It's always the highlight reels, the happy moments, and the smiling. And someone can really sit down who's had the same opportunities, who's in the same class as you, and realize that my life is going nowhere. Because the person that I've always looked up to or measured my life with here and there in a different class. So that can also be a danger in terms of stewardship and cybersecurity. The other one there is, I think we've been given an opportunity to make good use of the technology space, so the cyberspace.
Yeah.
And I think we need to re-examine how we're using it, and to what benefit we want to achieve out of this.
Yeah.
Because we can say, look, this is not important, I can be careless about it, but we lose the element of being good stewards there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. And let's end off on a note addressing parents. For a parent who's listening right now, how do they protect their children who are essentially growing up online? You know, I was seeing a video the other day of all the games we used to play as kids outside before the Apollo lights went on. But kids nowadays, they live and grow up and play and learn online. So how do parents then protect their children without breeding paranoia or even becoming control freaks?
Yeah, so I think this one is a little bit close to my heart, because I think this is my perception of the years I've looked around in terms of what parents are doing, is that they're sticking tablets in the hands of their kids. They're sticking phones in the hands of their kids to keep them busy so that they can attend to other important things in life. So in simple terms, a mother or father comes home from work. They are extremely tired. Work has been work to them. They don't have the energy or whatever to deal with the child. So they say to the child, here's a tablet. They open YouTube and say, watch on YouTube there. So therein lies the danger of the technology now parenting a child. And that child then goes on YouTube, and YouTube, with all of its suggestions, is now teaching this child life. Is now teaching this child morals, is now teaching this child what's right and what's wrong. So I think my advice to parents is, parents really need to, I mean, they need to take the time and spend it with their children. In as much as they're busy, they're tired, they have pressure, sometimes they have to work when they come home. I do understand that, but I think, in light of the previous question, the biggest stewardship that has been given to men is the accountability of who is my brother, right? That perspective, when we get to heaven, we'll be asked, those who are parents, where is your children?
Mm-hmm.
And we can't say, no, I gave the child the tablet. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of work to do. So that would be my biggest challenge to parents, to say that it's time we reclaim responsibility around the correct use of technology that children are facing. I'm not a parent myself, but I see it, even at church. You know, we walk into a church and parents want to concentrate on the sermon. They don't want to parent, and they hand their child they hand their child the tablet to play with and be still, you know. And that child then puts on ear pods and they are now in a world of their own. Close to a whole lot of dangers, because when we're children, our parents locked the gate.
For sure.
And all the kids that were seen as bad influences by our parents, they were out of the gate and they were in their homes. But now the children can chat to each other online, even older ones with younger ones, even those who, you know, they have got bad intentions towards children. I don't even want to mention cases that they now have access to your child. They can draw your child out of your home while you're sitting next to your child.
Crazy.
And I think for me, that one is very close to my heart. The fact that parents need to rethink the concept of how are they going to deal with technology. My suggestion is you need to know as a parent what your child is doing online.
And with all these black sites now, with all these WhatsApp channels, right? That bully kids, that share explicit content. It's so crazy. It is so, so crazy. There needs to be an intentional knowledge and guidance for kids.
Yeah. Sure. Look, in closing, let's pretend I'm not going to say this, but I'm going to say it at the same time. There is a documentary on Netflix where someone was cyberbullying a child. When you go through the documentary and you realize, once they did the forensic investigation, they couldn't find out who this person who was cyberbullying this child, who was suggesting to the child, why don't you go and kill yourself? Why don't you go and when you realize who was saying that, you would then take a step back and realize we live in a messed up world. And parents really, really, really need to really take control of what their children are getting exposed
to. Yo, my parting shot, I guess, would be, it's one thing to guard your data, and we need to really do that. But I think it's more important to guard our discernment. I think the one thing you emphasized over the times that we have had this conversation is just being mindful, being present, being aware, seeing things that are too good to be true for what they are, and making decisions based on that knowledge. And so, yeah, guard your data, but also guard your discernment.
100%.
Yeah. Thank you, Muyoa. Thank you for equipping us once again with truth and reminding us that digital safety truly does begin with digital mindfulness. I really appreciate having conversations with you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Miyama. And with that, I am Nompumelelo Lombonani, and I hope you have just made sense of your business. Fresh mercy tomorrow. Ciao for now.
Adventist World Radio SID Media. We are not general practitioners. We are specialists in Bible-based content.